This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and signature support comes from the good people at First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, I mean Walker, and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And we start with George Morris, who'll spend a good portion of the hour with us. George has been with us a few times through the years, and he is one of the most versatile reporters in America. He came this way 40 years ago. The exact date was September 27th.
Correct.
1982, and this is the 23rd, so we're just short of 40 years, and today is his final day at The Advocate, which swallowed up, if you will, the State Times, where George was first hired in the year of 1982 as the LSU beat writer, working with Sam King and Dan Hardesty, right?
Correct. And Burnell Ballard and Mike Cook and Joe Macaluso and Sheldon Mickles, Ron Duplantis. That was quite a crew.
And George at that time was a young lad. He just turned 27 years old, and he got a prize beat, and it was a big season for Jerry Stovall, the best of his four seasons, 1982. LSU went to the Orange Bowl, some memorable games, beat Alabama and Birmingham, and the Oranges coming down in Tiger Stadium against Florida State. And you came this way from Florida by way of the University of South Carolina, and I'm sure you never thought, never in your wildest imagination, thought you would end up being in Baton Rouge for 40 years.
No. I mean, of course, I mean, at the time, I worked at a newspaper that itself had gone out of business, an afternoon paper. And I had an offer in St. Louis to work on a news desk, and I had an offer here to work in sports. Decided to work here in sports. And, I probably figured it, you know, I would bounce around. And but then, although I actually was not hired as beat writer, Sam King was beat writer at the time, but when Dan Hardesty retired, in 84, I became beat writer. And yeah, that was a heck of a good gig, you know, beat writer for LSU football, mm-hmm. Southeastern Conference, traditional power. And so, but I just came to love it and loved, you know, enjoyed the atmosphere, enjoyed the job, enjoyed the people. South Louisiana is a unique place. You know that. Being yourself a transplant. And it grew on me. Hopefully I grew on some of the readers.
No doubt. And George is a person with a myriad of interests. He does not have what Howard Cosell once called dugout vision, referring to many sports writers who only want to cover games and the people who play or coach the games and have no interest in the stock market or national politics or crime or you name it, it's all about the games. Well, George has interest in not only about the now, but what got us to the now. And I think you have actually shown your abilities more profoundly since you quit being the LSU beat writer. And you certainly evolved into a great military historian. Was that something that you planned, or did it just kind of evolve?
Well, it kind of evolved. I was enjoying sports for a while, and it's funny. I reached kind of a point where I liked college football. I liked college sports. It was the energy, the excitement. But by the same token, I reached a point where I couldn't believe that it was Armageddon. You know that I can distinctly remember one night in the Assembly Center, and I forget who LSU was playing. May have been Kentucky. And I was sitting at a point where, as I looked down the court, you could also, out of my peripheral vision, see the fans and just how absolutely apoplectic they would be getting in bad calls and or things that didn't go their way, and starting to thinking, you know, I can't believe that this is that important. And then I sort of kind of, as that thought process grew, I started thinking, you know, but those fans deserve somebody who does think it's that important. So I started thinking
really?
About, yes.
You thought about that.
Yeah, and so that, you know, maybe I ought to find something, you know, different, because, you know, they deserve somebody who's bringing the heat, to use a baseball metaphor. And a position came open that was both writing for what was then called the People section, the Daily Feature section, and we then had two weekend, the Friday Fun section and Sunday Magazine. And I thought, well, this would be cool. This would be an interesting way to explore other things. And so I did.
But if a sports writer is a fan, I think that might be a problem on occasion.
Well, not necessarily a fan, but also just, but again, just thinking whether you're for this team or not, just thinking that this is just the most uber important thing, you know, in the world. And I came to not do that. And so I made the move actually in the spring of 92. And as it happened, you know, in terms of World War II, it just sort of, the timing was right for all the 50th anniversaries, save Pearl Harbor, of U.S. involvement in World War II to be coming along at that time. And so I approached the, my editors about, hey, why don't we just find some of these veterans? And there've got to be stories. At the time, I didn't know who I was going to talk to or how I was going to find them. You know, I would call, you know, VFW posts and Legion posts and things like this. And I started finding these people with incredible stories.
And you now have a body of work that is immense of interviews with these veterans. And you did it at a time when you could still talk with them. And now many of them, of course, are past that point. Then some of them, most of them.
Oh, the vast majority are dead. Yeah. I mean, there are very few World War II veterans that you can talk to. And the key, actually, the key thing there was getting them to talk, because many of them didn't want to. And I think that, you know, the passage of time made it so that they could, more of them could. But many of them took their stories to the grave. It was just, there was a lot of pain that they had to bury. There was PTSD that they just, you know, they didn't want to deal with.
And at that point, they didn't even have a name for it. But obviously, when we look at casualties, there were about as many men who were killed in the Battle of the Bulge as there was in the whole Vietnam War, a five-week battle. So it was, World War II was the real deal.
Well, it was. And quite frankly, it was even realer, to coin a phrase, on the Eastern Front. I mean, the battles of Kursk and Stalingrad, and these were huge numbers of tanks and men. It was incredible.
And the Pacific Theater was no picnic either.
Well, the Pacific Theater was no picnic. The Japanese did not observe the Geneva Convention. I mean, there was a different mindset about, you know, about battle. And, you know, other than perhaps people who were shot down or those who were captured in the Philippines at Bataan, you know, there were very few prisoners taken.
And George used his background in sports to cover some of the people who he'd covered as coaches. Notably, and I'm thinking of John Ferguson, who was a broadcaster, Paul Dietzel. Paul Dietzel was a true war hero.
Oh, yes. I mean, he flew bombing missions over Japan.
When he was a teenager. Or close to it. He was born in 24.
24. No, so I mean, he would not. He would have been. I mean, and that's the crazy thing. I mean, a lot of times and I think partly because, you know, you see movie and TV depictions of World War II, and they're played by older actors. I mean, Tom Hanks was way too old to be a captain in Saving Private Ryan. I mean, he was just way too old, and Stephen Ambrose told him that.
Yeah, he was 42.
Right. I mean, you know, a 42-year-old captain. You know, I mean, that's it was just crazy.
He was pretty good in that film.
Oh, he was wonderful in the film. Well, he's a splendid actor. I was no criticism of that. But I think that our mentality is that these people were much older than they were. And no, I mean they were teens.
I know.
I just actually wrote a book about. I mean, I wrote a story about the book that Walt Larimore wrote about his dad, Phil Larimore, who was truly a war hero, one of the Distinguished Service Cross and two Silver Stars and two Bronze Stars and three Purple Hearts. And he actually was commissioned an officer at age 17. He was commissioned an officer before he got his Boy Scout Eagle Award. And of course, then ended up, you know, fighting at Anzio in southern France.
You remember Jack German, the great journalist who went to Baton Rouge High. When he got out of high school, he said that you wanted to go. he got in right at the end of the war. That it was totally different from Vietnam, when, as we know, people were running for the hills. You were trying to get in the war. You wanted to fight for our country.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, to put it simply, you know, Vietnam really didn't attack us. They didn't attack us at Pearl Harbor. And people can talk about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and that there's a lot of question whether was even legitimate.
Of course, but it was a different mindset.
No question.
And unfortunately, I don't know that if we were attacked, that there would be the same kind of patriotic fervor today as there was in World War II.
Perhaps not. I think that there certainly was a groundswell after 9/11.
There was, but unfortunately, we didn't attack the right people. But that's a story for another day. 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org. Back with George Morris after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. By the way, podcasts are available all the time, every moment of the day at WRKF.org and at talklouisiana.org. George Morris is with us. It's his final day at the Advocate. He started with the State Times, but in those days, the Advocate was on Lafayette Street, that regal building that went down for the count. I'm amazed that it wasn't on the National Register of Historic Places, but they tore it down. It had shown some wear and tear, as you know, but the walls could talk. If the walls could talk, the story's there. And George went to work there, and there was a morning paper and an afternoon paper, both thriving and both extremely good, and both had exceptional sports sections. And George evolved into a feature writer, writing not only about military matters, but everything else. And every now and then, they would call him back into action to cover sports. You went to Tuscaloosa several years ago, didn't you?
A couple of times. I went back for the first time they played after Saban became coach. And then I went back again in 2011.
The game of the century.
The game, the biggest game ever, so to speak. And then I got to cover the Saints in the Super Bowl also, which was a really exceptionally cool experience.
Yeah. And both the game of the century and the Super Bowl are markers. Now, LSU, as it turned out, actually lost by winning the game of the century. They had to play one more game, because they won the Southeastern Conference Western Division, and as a result, they played in the SEC Championship. They win that, beat the you-know-what out of Georgia, and then they meet Alabama again. And Alabama was fresh and ready and 21-0, and Nick Saban ended up winning the national championship. If Les Miles had won that night, George, he and Saban would have been tied with two national titles. Now Saban has seven, Miles has one.
Well, you never know how things are going to work out, do you?
No, and a reporter from Tiger Rag called Les Miles the other day and asked him why he wasn't invited to the 2011 reunion they had last week. They honored him at halftime and before the game, and he said, you know, Miles was not happy that he was not invited. That's just not right. That's just not right. But, you know, he's in hot water with this lawsuit, but he did coach the team. You can't erase history.
Well, this is true. Certainly the things that were alleged in terms of his, you know, kind of his off the field behavior, you know, were such that I guess that there's a sense of embarrassment and appropriately so. I mean, let's face it. I think that there are some people who are still employed at the athletic department who probably shouldn't be, based on some of their participation in the things that that also involved that time and the treatment of females, both athletes and non-athletes, by the football department.
Well, if you and I were to go through our years in journalism together, and we were in the same city and interviewed many of the same people, I think if we had a list of our top five interviewees, both of us would have one name on that list, and his name is Dale Duard Brown.
Yes, no question, no question. Dale is a force of nature. He is just one of the most fascinating people that I've ever dealt with. He was one of those a lot of coaches, I sort of call them just sort of coaching androids. It's like, seems like that they really can't get their mind outside of the four corners of the field or the court or the, you know, whatever it is that they're coaching. And Dale had and has so many interests and passions. I mean, not just, you know, hobbies, but passions that, and you just never knew what he was going to say at any time. I really enjoyed. Sometimes it was exasperating because, you know, he would go off on what you kind of felt was an irrelevant tangent, but it sure was fun.
Yeah, I think Sports Illustrated, Curry Kirkpatrick noted that rarely do you find a basketball coach who opens a press conference after a game talking about Imelda Marcos, but Dale Brown did.
Or Mother Teresa or whomever. Yeah, I mean, it was.
But he is also one of those people who did not find sports to be the be-all and end-all. It was a means for him to do other things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, he was very involved with, you know, correcting what he thought were injustices. And I mean, if he saw somebody that he thought was getting a raw deal, I mean, he would pour all of himself into it, just as much of himself into that as he would be preparing to beat Joby Hall at Kentucky. I mean, that's just the nature of him. And it's one of the admirable qualities about him. It was not that he wasn't a basketball android, that he was, you know, a human being with interests and concerns far beyond, you know, putting a ball in a hoop.
And of his 160 players, he has worked fervently to get them through college. His foundation has paved the way for many of them. And he worked hard enough that now 114 of them have degrees. And the last two in the last graduation at LSU, Dwayne Spencer, age 50, and Vernell Singleton, age 52. So he has worked hard, and now he has a graduation rate over 70%. And many of them, of course, graduated after he retired in 1997. So he did great work in that realm, and he views his players as sons. Floyd Bailey, who played for him in the 70s, told me the other day that Coach Brown calls him about every 2 weeks, and there aren't many coaches who do that.
I assume that you are correct.
I can't imagine them doing it. Dean Smith, though, when he died, he gave every player who had played for him, every letterman, $500. He said, go out and have a dinner on Coach Smith.
Well, that's... There was another great one that I never really spent a lot of time around Smith. I did get to interview him one time at a press conference. He was obviously one of the giants of the game.
Mm-hmm. Now, George, in his last appearance on this show, it was on, I believe, Pete Maravich's anniversary, January 5th, 1988. Pistol Pete died at 40, and George and I sat together in George's church at Pete's funeral. And you said he was the greatest college basketball player of all time. And George knows a bit about college basketball because he grew up in South Carolina. And at that time, the University of South Carolina was, next to UCLA, perhaps the preeminent program in the country. And you had some great players. A guy who was, when you looked at him, wasn't much to look at, but he was a great college player, John Roche.
Yes. I mean, he was one of these guys that was just tough and gritty and played incredible defense, but was a great passer and a great ball handler and a great shooter. Did not have a great NBA career. But
he played a long time in the league.
But he played a long time in the league. And, of course, Frank McGuire was the coach at South Carolina at the time. And here's someone who, just was great at St. John's, was great at North Carolina. I think he was at the time the first and may still be the only one who won 100 games at three different schools. And then coached a year, in the NBA. And so it was, he was remarkable.
And when you were in school, one of the great games at South Carolina where Paul Dietzel was the head coach, 1973, LSU 33, South Carolina 29. Still breaks your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah, I still kind of cringe when I think about that game. I was a freshman. I won't bore you with the details, but I had gotten amazing tickets. I was like sitting right on the 50-yard line, 14 rows up. It was a back-and-forth game. It was – it's a shame that it was in an era when, you know, today games, everything's televised. But at the time, you know, very few games were televised. And so if you weren't there, there may be some kind of video clips from it.
Well, but I remember Mike Miley, the late Mike Miley. He was, I think it was third and 23, and he's running for his life. And they had him, actually had him, and he got away. I think the reason was the tearaway jersey. And he throws a pass with just his shoulder pads, and he finds
Ben Jones alone on the sidelines. And I mean, alone on the sidelines. And then he catches and runs the ball down to around the 5 yard line or in, and LSU punches it in. I've become good friends with Ben over the years, and I've told him that I've forgiven him for the damage he did to my psyche.
And one of the other receivers was Robert Dow, the father of our producer, Robin Dow. And why somebody didn't have the Dow Jones average, I don't know. That was an easy one. We're back with George after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. George Morris, wrapping up 40 years today at The Advocate. There will be a celebration of his exceptional career today at the offices, which now are in a different location. But George has stayed the course. Think back in 1982 when he became the reporter for the State Times. President was Ronald Reagan. The mayor was Pat Screen. The football coach was Jerry Stovall. Much has changed in Baton Rouge and Louisiana, and there have been a number of people in those positions since, but George Morris has been a constant, and as noted, he found a way to report on other matters and use his immense talents to unearth nuggets of interest far and wide. And a listener noted that one of the things you've done lately is you've gone back and you've looked at the skyline of Baton Rouge. Skyline's changed a little bit through the years, but there's some of those buildings. I was looking at the photos not so long ago. It's amazing. Some of the buildings downtown are the same ones that were there 80 years ago.
Yeah, there are some landmark places, such as the Romaine Building. And also right now, I'm forgetting I think it was the Union National Life, you know, building right there on the corner of 3rd and Florida. I mean, yeah, there are a number, and obviously the what's now the Hilton, the old Heidelberg, and the hotel across the street from it. You know, there are a number of real landmark buildings. Obviously, the cathedral, as places that that are still there, the old state capitol, naturally.
Yeah, well, some people are commenting. One, our friend Lester Douay, who covered the 1982 Tigers when you were there. George went from football to features to food to field artillery. Pleasant guy, fine scribe. I love alliteration, and there's Lester Douay right at the ready with this. And George has a number of people in all walks of life who have admired his work, and he's been a professor, an adjunct professor at LSU, too. That's going to continue, isn't it?
Yes, it is. They're allowing me to teach. I teach a class. It's one of the basic media writing classes that all those who want to major in mass comm have to take. So there are multiple sessions each year. They've been allowing me to teach remotely, and so I will continue that, even though I plan to be relocating to be close to grandchildren
in Nashville or near Nashville.
Near Nashville.
I hear that's a pretty good city.
It's a lovely city. It really is, and you know, it's. The topography reminds me a lot of South Carolina, you know, much more rolling. It's a good place. We're looking forward to it.
I couldn't imagine you in San Francisco.
Well, I'm not a big city person, you know, anywhere.
But you're a Southern guy.
I'm definitely a Southern guy. And we're actually going to be living in a much more rural area. A lot of my neighbors will have goats and mules and cows and chickens and things like that. So it will definitely be a won't quite be Green Acres, but it'll be close enough.
Today on his Facebook page, George posted a photo as he leaves the Advocate, and the cover shot is one when you arrived at the State Times. And the years do change our appearance, but George, you I can certainly tell it's George Morris, and you still have that laugh. And I remember you used to laugh at the people who covered sports with us. We had some real characters, didn't we?
Oh, did we? I mean, of course, and I worked for one of them. Sam King is one of the the great sports writing characters of all times. He was certainly a very capable writer and thoughtful, but he was one of the world's greatest practical jokers. And eventually, even though you suspected him, he would catch you at a weak moment, and he would pull the wool over your eyes. It was an amazing talent that I don't have.
And Sam, in his day, was a pretty good athlete.
Yes, he was. I mean, I think he played on a high school Class B championship basketball, state championship basketball team at Live Oak back there in Watson. And yes, he was. I occasionally played tennis with him, and I found that the harder I hit the ball, the better he returned. So I thought, you know, I better start hitting more little dinky spin shots, because, I mean, his reactions were really good.
Well, Steve Myers, the founder of Tiger Rag, told a story when he was in his 20s. He ran in the old Great River Road Run in 6.2 miles, and he's rounding the corner heading for home, and he looks, and about 100 yards in front of him is a guy 20 years older, Sam King, smoking a cigar because he's finishing the 6.2 mile race in about 50 minutes.
Yes. Sam got a lot of dirty looks that day from runners who did not appreciate. Of course, and part of it, and I'm going to go ahead and just tell the truth here. Sam smoked cigars, but these were not Cuban. These were not, these were just awful. You know, well, I won't insult the brands, but he smoked cheap cigars too, which may have made it even worse.
Well, you'll be missed in Baton Rouge. I suspect you'll come back every now and then, I would hope.
I certainly expect to. I mean, you spend 40 years in a place, essentially your adult life. You know, I mean, you make so many friends. And we certainly expect to. And, you know, my wife still has family. Not in Baton Rouge proper, but she has a brother in Houma. She has a brother in West Feliciana Parish. We have, you know, nieces and nephews and all like that that are still around here.
And George will find a way to keep life interesting. As I stated, he's more than the games people play. You read books. You actually read books.
Well, yes, occasionally some. You know, some that even you don't need to color. I mean, they're actually it's just that they're word oriented.
It's amazing how many people don't read books. Well, of any kind.
Yeah, it's
even coloring books.
True enough.
But you've had this remarkable, as John Ferguson would say, you've had a good run. And a listener asked about Ferguson. We missed him when we were talking about war service. He, too, was a hero, and he was a bit older than Dietzel, about 5 years older. But he was fortunate to come back from World War II.
Yeah, he flew some interesting missions. The Allies were trying to keep China in the war, you know, against Japan. And to do that, they had to run supplies from India to China, and they had to cross the Himalayas to do it. And the pilots call that flying the hump. And the way you described it, it was extremely difficult conditions. Obviously, not just the altitude, but the weather systems that they would encounter up there. And, of course, once you get over the Himalayas, I mean, there's no place to land a plane. You know, I mean, there's no flat ground. So it was, yes, he had some incredible stories.
And he, of course, was a voice of the Tigers for about 40 years and kind of a throwback, that deep baritone voice, a beautiful voice, and a guy who, if you got to know him, he was a funny fellow, but on the surface, he came across as anything but. And George is smiling.
Yes, I mean.
An interesting hairstyle, too.
Well, interesting hairstyle. But yes, I mean, you know, he was a great professional, you know, broadcaster. But, you know, I mean, you know, he reminds me of yourself. He reminds me of people like Dan Bornay, who, of course, you know, has that same wonderful kind of baritone, tones that just come across so well across particularly radio waves. I mean, and I can remember at times when I was in high school and of that age, you know, sometimes picking up an LSU game at night off WWL. And hearing John Ferguson.
As did I.
And it was, an outstanding, outstanding broadcaster.
And Walter Hill and Pat Screen and Doug Morrow, they were ahead of the pack. I think Pat Screen was the first sideline reporter of any kind in the country for any broadcast doing LSU. And, of course, he had an amazing life that ended tragically. But collectively, they were a big part of our youth. For those of us who listened to 870 AM WWL, it was amazing hearing the voice of John Ferguson every Saturday night. And that was the reason we could hear them, is because the games were at night. And LSU at that time was one of the few schools to play night games.
True. True. I mean, yeah, I mean, most stadiums did not even have lights. I mean, it was not even possible. I mean, I remember well into my, you know, college days, you know, Georgia couldn't play at night. Now, mm-hmm. South Carolina, and that's one of the, I think that was also one of the Dietzel influences. When he came there, he, you know, mm-hmm. he kind of pushed them to play more night games. But yeah, I remember many places where, you know, night games weren't even possible. Mm-hmm. It was an afternoon sport. So yeah, I mean, you had this Clear Channel station and very little competition for people to listen. So I mean, that was one of the things that made I think that the people who decided to do that were really, you know, pretty sharp in terms of creating an image for LSU.
George Morris, congratulations on a great career that I'm sure will continue in a different way, but we will remember you fondly here and look forward to your heroic return at some point.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. You've been a good friend and a credit to your profession as well.
Well, thank you. And I do. I have a lot of acquaintances and a few friends, and George and I have not had a lot of contact through the years of late, but I do consider him a friend, and I've admired his work immensely. So keep going, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
And we're joined now by Jim Meskimen. He's a fine actor who has many interests, and he is the son of the incomparable Marion Ross, who was on Happy Days for many years, and Jim has worked with Ronnie Howard on many endeavors, the great actor who was Opie on Andy Griffith and then Richie Cunningham on Happy Days. And Jim, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning to you. Thank you for that nice introduction.
Well, you are not resting on your laurels. I know you've got a number of projects that are ongoing now, and we're going to get to those. We do have to take a short break, but among other things, Jim is quite an impersonator. So, and the listener is aware of you. It reminded me of this. So hopefully we'll get an impersonation or two in our time with him. But he's had an amazing career, and he has much to talk about the world in which he inhabits, which many of us, of course, are quite interested in. We're back after this quick pause with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. We're spending a few minutes with Jim Meskimen, a fascinating man who is a man of many talents. His career began as a visual artist doing illustrations and commercial art in New York City. And then he was, and still is, one of the most sought-after voice actors in the country. Did hundreds of radio and television commercials. What were some of those most memorable commercials you did, Jim?
Oh, gosh. The radio seems like a far, far off memory. Radio commercials were my bread and butter for so long when I was in New York. But and radio obviously still exists. We're talking on radio, but it's become less of my life now, except for the Colonel Sanders work that I do now for KFC. I've been doing that for quite a while. And that's a great pleasure to evoke that the great Harlan Sanders, who, of course, comes from a farming background, like many of your listeners.
Colonel Sanders is portrayed very well by Jim Meskimen. You also have a connection to the first president of the United States, don't you? George Washington?
In a very slender way. Yeah, I did a commercial for Geico a few years ago. Some of your listeners may remember where I played George Washington crossing the Delaware Expressway, which was a funny gag that had these men pushing me in my boat, like the famous painting. Across the Delaware Expressway, and with people honking at it, and gosh, that was a lot of fun to do. And I had a lot of prosthetic makeup on to make me resemble George Washington. But I gave him a deep stentorian sort of Washington voice. Of course, there are no existing recordings of George Washington, and many people think that he might have spoken with a British accent, since he was part of the British Army in his youth. But anyway, that was a lot of fun to do.
And you've got a project going on right now, and it is with a couple of exceptional actors, Sean Penn and Julia Roberts, both of whom have done one great film, Steel Magnolias, one not so great film in Louisiana by Sean, All the King's Men. But they are, you talk about talented people, they're among the most talented in the business, aren't they?
Yeah, they're Oscar winners. They're very talented professionals, and it's always kind of nervy, you know, when you go to the set and you're going to work with somebody who has such a background and such a history and such altitude, let's say. But in my case, I had it kind of easy because when I met Sean Penn, for example, he was already in makeup as John Mitchell. And if anyone has seen Gaslit, you know that he's pretty unrecognizable. He's covered from stem to stern with quite a lot of prosthetic makeup, so that when he came up to me and said, "Hey, hey there, I'm Sean," I said, "If you say so." it certainly was no visual evidence of it at all, except for, you know, his eyes. Every bit of the head was completely covered up and beautifully designed to look like someone else. So that actually was helpful. You know, otherwise I might have been just a little bit starstruck. Even I have worked in movies and TV for 35 years. If I meet somebody whose work I've appreciated and who's been a big star, like Tom Hanks or something like that, it takes me a while to get used mm-hmm. to him.
You've done five films with Ron Howard. Now, he of course, has evolved into a director, producer. He does everything, but many of us remember him as Opie. But he's pretty special, isn't he?
Well, yeah. I mean, he's not only a director, producer. He is one of the top directors of all time. I don't know if you've seen his latest film, 13 Lives, about the rescue attempt that was made, the actual rescue that was made in the Thai caves that flooded a couple of years ago. But this movie with Colin Farrell, I'm not in the movie, by the way, I'm just plugging it because it's a great movie. Ron Howard did such a fantastic job. And there's nobody else that can really direct certain kinds of films. And a big high adventure like that, which is based on a true story, it reminded me a lot of Apollo 13, which I was in, where it really was a great story of mankind against the elements. It wasn't a mm-hmm. story about some psychopath holding a button and an explosive somewhere. It had to be thwarted by superheroes. It was a battle to save lives against really against the physical universe, the limitations of people trapped in a cave, and how these men actually did it. It was 13 Lives is a fantastic film.
Jim Meskimen, a fine actor and grew up in a family of Hollywood royalty. How was it having your mom being the mom on Happy Days?
Well, it sure didn't feel like royalty most of the time. It felt like struggling, hardworking. You know, Marion, my mom, was a single mom raising two kids, not famous, in a difficult business. And before Happy Days, and she was a hustler. She struggled and worked the opportunities and managed to pull it off. She's written a book called My Days, Happy and Otherwise, which talks about this very much. But from my vantage point, this was a hardworking person who came from, you know, a Minnesota background, who really was not like drop-dead gorgeous, but just was very talented and very hardworking. And she really pulled herself up by her own bootstraps and made something for herself and her family. But the success came well into her 40s. So I've always found that very heartening, that a person who works hard, even in such a difficult business as show business, can do very well if they just put themselves to it.
And that cast had a lot of journeymen. It's like Tom Bosley. I mean, these people were not Paul Newman, but mm-hmm. what an amazing cast. Henry Winkler, Anson Williams, Donnie Most. Many of these people I've talked with, Most. Including your mother. It was a remarkable collection, and they certainly played well off each other.
Well, that's a tribute to Gary Marshall, I think, who was the show creator, who created the TV show The Odd Couple and Laverne and Shirley and Robin Williams' show, Mark for Mark, you know, That's it. Mork and Mindy, that was a wonderful show, too. He created that. So Gary was a real brilliant creative force and a very sweet man. And in fact, we just saw a lot of his family. He's got a he passed away a couple of years ago now, but he established a theater in Burbank that puts on wonderful family entertainment. We went to see Don Most, the great Don Most.
I know he's a great singer, by the way.
He's become a great jazz singer. So he gets an orchestra, a small group, a band. This is my Don Most impression, and he sings you know, the great songs of you know, the 40s and 50s, Bobby Darin songs and other great songs. So yeah, there were a lot of journeymen, and they all, you know, were relatively unknown to America, except for Ron Howard and possibly Tom Bosley, who had won a Tony on Broadway. But the rest of them, Henry Winkler, those guys you mentioned, they were unknowns. Mm-hmm. And Happy Days introduced them to the world and made the world fall in love with them. And they still are remembered today. Like my mom, you know, anytime I tell people on a set or something, I let it leak that who my mom is, they go, "Oh, I love your mom," which is a really nice thing.
What's next for you, Jim?
Well, I just got back from New York yesterday. Actually, I was working on a show called FBI Most Wanted, where I play a criminal. And that was an interesting excursion for me. But I've got a show that's launching sometime in the fall called The Big Door Prize on Apple TV with the very talented actor Chris O'Dowd. And he's Irish, you know, and I had to learn to mimic him a little bit for the show.
Well, thank you, my friend. And we do have to roll. But fine man, hopefully we'll talk again soon. And a remarkable career, Jim Meskimen. Thank you for being with
thanks
us.
So much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Jim.
And we're joined in our remaining moments by one of the more remarkable singers in our country, Jonathan Butler, who will be performing tonight at Hemingbow. And there are tickets at eventbrite.com. But for those unfamiliar with Jonathan Butler, he has an amazing body of work. And Jonathan, you will be in St. Francisville. I know the people are quite excited about you and Warring Women, the main event. Tell us more.
Well, good morning. Good morning to you. I think it's probably 3 hours late in LA, and I'm just waking up, and I'm good. I'm happy to be here. I think I did this before. I did this event before a while back, and so I'm happy to be back, and hopefully we're going to have a great evening.
Well, you've been doing this a little while, and for those who are into your kind of music, which some might term as religious, but I think that is far too narrow to describe what you do. You're one of the great singers of any kind.
Yes.
But you've done it a long time. What do you attribute your staying power to?
Well, you know, I believe it's the, you know, I'm a lover of music. I'm a student of music. I'm always growing. I'm a South African. My music is actually world music rather than be religious. I don't believe I have I have more love for God than having a religious bone. But what I do is really been God's, you know, plan since I was born out of my mother's womb to do music. I come from a family of musicians. We all are musicians. My mother's grandkids mm-hmm. are musicians. My niece and nephews, we're all musicians in South Africa. And so my music has evolved over the years. I'm 6 years old, so I've been performing since 7 years old and making records since I was 12. And I'm still making records. I actually have a new record coming out next year that's produced by Marcus Miller, the great Marcus Miller.
Jonathan Butler, that's the incomparable Jonathan Butler, will be on hand tomorrow night, 6:30 at Hemingbow, and Warring Women Saturday, Saturday, this is Jonathan tonight at Hemingbow, and Saturday, Warring Women. So it is a major event at Hemingbow, and for more information, go to eventbrite.com. Jonathan starts tonight at 6:30 p.m. The gates open, and he'll perform shortly thereafter.